Good evening. Right. Well, it's nice to see you. It's nice to be seen, I can tell you that. We've got a number from the annals of rock history. It's not called Black Dog Jimmy, it's just called The Craftsman.
Hello, and welcome to the Ramble On podcast. I am Brian Gardner. I write the blog Ramble On, and I got looking for some podcasts, Led Zeppelin-based podcasts, and discovered there really was nothing regular there. And so made the decision that I would have a go at doing my own, and here I am. So let's see how this goes. If it works out well, if it gets a positive response, I'll keep it going. And just awesome. Here I am today. I'm launching a new podcast just like that. Sit down, record it. I'm going to put it out there. And, you know, if you're going to count down a website and make a big fuss about it, it really should, you know, you count down before an explosion. It should explode. It should be something amazing. And it was just a ho-hum. It was just really just a website. Now, I'm up in Canada, I'm up in Toronto area, we have seen neither hide nor hair of Black Country Communion, and after two albums, and I've been pushing this band, and writing about this band, and I'm a little PO'd that they've come nowhere near us, and I get that the weather's not as good here as it is in California. I get you would rather be in California than Toronto, but, you know, we're up here, and we'd love to catch the band. John Paul Jones spent the summer, presumably he's writing his opera. He would be well past 30 minutes at this stage. Good Lord, I'm at 45 minutes. Four-year-old Missouri man has legally changed his name from George F. Blackburn to Led Zeppelin II. Yes, like the 1969 album by Led Zeppelin, I reinvented myself, Zeppelin told StLouisToday.com via Boing Boing. We live in a strange world. But I don't know what I would change my name to. Maybe I'll just go with Achilles. That's kind of a cool name. That's me. This is Achilles Gardner signing off.
Hello, this is Achilles Gardner. Yes, that's right. I've been to the courthouse, and like George F. Blackburn of Methalto, Missouri, who changed his name to Led Zeppelin II, I am now Achilles, last stand Gardner. Last name Achilles, middle names last and stand. On the government paperwork, it comes out as Gardner, Achilles LS.
This is Brian. Call me Achilles Gardner. I've had to change my name back. Once the wife found out I had changed my name to Achilles, last stand, let's just say it was time to change it back. She was none too pleased either to find out that I changed the kids' names. The daughter was Tangerine, and the 14-year-old boy, logically enough, was Fool in the Rain, and it suited him, but she wasn't too pleased. So back they go too, the names, not the kids.
I say what? Ho, oh, this is Brian. Call me Achilles Gardner. Coming to you from the Galley Studio in Ramble On Towers in scenic Hesper, Ontario. You are listening to Ramble On Radio, the 100th episode, number 100, triple digits, made it on the Off the Puff, Off the Cuff podcasting network. Ramble On Radio is the only Led Zeppelin podcast on this or any other known internets. And be sure to go to RambleOnRadio.com for all your Led Zeppelin news, reviews, and any links I might happen to mention during the show. You can subscribe to Ramble on Radio through iTunes. And if you're in iTunes, go over to Ramble on Radio, even if you're buying, you're buying Taylor Swift's latest. You're buying, whatever, you caught Kanye West doing Bohemian Rhapsody, and you thought, I got to get more of this guy. You're over at the Kanye West side of iTunes. Just do a quick search for Ramble on Radio. It comes up fairly quickly. Leave a review. And by leaving a review, we place it in. It makes it come up for other people quickly is one of the things that does. You can check it out at Podbean, where this is the original download comes from Podbean at I Am Brian Dammit. You can listen to it on Spreaker, Spreaker.com. And if you're at Spreaker, just follow me. Just sign up and then follow me. And everybody, if you're listening to this for the first time, the 100th episode is your first episode, pop over to Spreaker, sign up. It costs nothing. It is easy. They don't bug you too much. And click on it. Click on me. Follow. Lots of follows, and I can apply to iHeartRadio. I'm going to send episode 100 to iHeartRadio. But they like to see, one of the things they like to see is lots of activity on Spreaker. Because they own that. So, yeah, go give it a follow, and maybe that'll help get it in front of thousands of people. And, of course, you can check out Ramble on Radio on YouTube. Follow Ramble on Radio and Facebook, Google+, and at Ramble on Blog on Twitter. And this is going to be a long one, folks. That's all I can say. The intro was, we're at 7 minutes and I'm just through the intro here, right? So, but I'll give you a little what you got there. First off, you got Jimmy Page introducing Black Dog on July 7, 1980, the last concert, Berlin, 1980. It was the final Led Zeppelin show. Nobody knew it at the time, but John Bonham would die 3 months later. And But that was Jimmy Page. During that, one of the interesting things in that tour was Jimmy Page was taking to the microphone between songs. He was introducing Black Dog. On that show as well, they changed the set list up or something. And Jimmy gets up between the songs and they have to change. It's before White Summer and the guitar is not in tune the way it was supposed to be. And he kind of, while they're off-tuning the guitar, he has a little chat with the audience. So he's doing a little bit of audience chit-chat. And you hear in that clip, he says, he mentions something in the next song, and somebody yells, "It's Black Dog Jimmy," and he goes, "No, it's not called Black Dog Jimmy." So that was Jimmy at the microphone. Into Bronwyar, I don't know. I've never known how to properly pronounce that. I think it's Bron Rar, is the way it's supposed to be. But that was me playing it. I've used that clip. I've used a portion of that for intro purposes, 30 seconds, 45 seconds before. That was the only time I think I've played the entire piece for you guys. I recorded that, it's got to be 10 years ago now. And you catch at the end the John Bonham-esque coughing. That was my son, who was probably about 8 at the time. And I was downstairs for about 2 hours recording this. And there was always one, oh, Christ, I flubbed that bit. Oh, I flubbed in it. And recording is frustrating because a little tiny mistake, it kills the whole thing. And so you spend forever just going over and over and over trying to get it just perfect. So I nailed it. I got what I wanted anyway, something I was happy with. I got it. And just as I was closing off, my son walks downstairs and coughs. So, in Led Zeppelin style, I said, well, it's the better take, so it stays. The cough stays. And he actually talks. If I let it linger just a second longer, he actually says something to me. In his very cute little 8-year-old boy voice, which is nice to have preserved in a way because he doesn't have that anymore. He has a big 18-year-old man voice. And he grunts. He doesn't actually talk so much as he grunts. Yeah, yeah, no. So that's what that was. And on top of that, You got the very first introduction to the very first podcast, the first 45 seconds or so, me saying, hello, this is Brian, this is why I'm doing this. And plus some clips from the very first episode. A little rant about Black Country Communion and not touring outside of a very small area. Me going on about the time. The first episodes, I was very obsessed with the time. I assumed I would sit down and start doing this, and I would talk, and I would look and go, oh, it's only been 3 minutes. What am I going to say? And it's actually very much the opposite. I'm almost shocked. Always, still, I'm shocked at how time flies when I sit down to do this. And I say what I think is, my wife says to me, what the hell do you talk about? Not that she couldn't listen. This is, you know, not that she couldn't just listen and find out what I talk about, but that would be... that would be out of the range of doable, apparently. But so she wonders, what are you talking? I go, you know, I don't even know sometimes, but Jesus, it doesn't take much. Time really flies when you're talking. And interestingly, if you're just sitting listening, it slows down, doesn't it? One of those little quirks of life. So that was Brian Ryan, first podcast. And then after that, a little shtick from the third and fourth podcast, I believe it was. Maybe third, fourth, fifth on me coming up with the name Achilles for myself. You heard how I came up with the name. Then I played around with it a bit and didn't change my name. But the point behind that was I'm still using that, what I came up with at that time. And that led into the me calling myself, this is Brian, call me Achilles. Brian Achilles Gardner, Brian such Gardner, Brian call me something Gardner. And every episode I kind of try and include something that's relevant to the episode, or occasionally just because I think it's fun. And if you have to pay really, if you're really a studier of the podcast, and you really pay close attention, most of the time when I say this is Brian such and such, and I give myself... I'm using a Led Zeppelin song line, always. And it's usually relevant to the episode somehow. Sometimes very subtly, very below, and it's just, this came up. You know, maybe Robert Plant played that song this week. I might not even mention it in the podcast, but maybe he played that song that week for the first time in a long time. And so I go to that for... And it's usually something comes up, and I think of that song, and then go, okay, because I don't have a list of these that I just randomly generate. So I go look at the lyrics and go, okay, there's one I can use. That's usually what happens. Every once in a while, I have to pull something out. And then I'll go to Achilles or my actual personal favorite, the New Orleans Queen Who Sure Knows How to Schmooze It. That's a little long for a business card, but that's the one I prefer. This is Brian, the New Orleans Queen Who Sure Knows How to Schmooze It, Gardner. And so that's that. Anyway... Getting on with business. Two quick things. Both came up today, actually. Well, one came up today. One I finally got around to posting today. First is Led Zepp gear. Jeff Strawman, I've talked about it. There's a link at Ramble On Radio now. He's at 75% of his funding. He needs to get about another $2,600, and he's got 22 days left in his 30-day drip, which is realistically, he's at 75% at about... 22 days left, he's at about 70% of his drive, right? And another, yeah, maybe even 65 to 70% is where he is time-wise, and he's at 75% money-wise. So realistically, I would say it's going well, assuming it all didn't come on the first day. But if you haven't funded yet, Led Zepp gear, $15 will get you an ebook copy of the book. He'll use the money to produce the book. $40 will get you a hard copy of the book, a hard cover of the book. So, I think you go on over and drop some money on the site. It's a good book. I seen the first chapter and a half, 37 pages, I believe it is, way back when. It'll have been edited, updated, approved, etc. But a year ago, I saw that, and it was very good. So Jeff is, he's 22 days left. I got to mark up my calendar. Yeah, I maybe got to try and get him on for a 5-minute chat. And we'll get everybody, get everybody on board with getting him his money. And the other one is Scarlet Page's Resonator. She had tried to crowdsource this before, and it didn't. They ended up pulling it. I don't know what the issues were at the time, but she's back. She's just today announced a Kickstarter campaign to fund the production of her book, Resonators. She's looking for £16,000 for production costs. And anybody, if you donate £50, you will get a copy of the book. £65 will get you a signed copy of the book. It's a hardcover book. It's 170 pages or something like that. On her website, she's actually got a big chunk of... let me see if I can bring it up quickly. But I have links to both of those is what it boils down to. Portfolio projects. It does not say. No, it does not say. I thought it said how big it was and stuff, but it's a big coffee table style book, and it's pictures of guitarists. Yes, here we go. 112 pages, 230 millimeters by 300 millimeters. I don't know what that is offhand. I'm not going to try. I'm not even going to try. Or should I? And 50 pounds, and it's 11 inches. 230, right? 230. 9 by 11. 11 by 9 book. 120 pages. 112 pages. And she's got a number of pictures on the site. If you go play around with the site, she's got some pictures of it. It will feature a number of guitarists. Here's the guitarists who took part in the project: Albert Lee, Billy Corgan, Brian May, Chrissy Hine, Dick Taylor from The Pretty Things, Graham Coxon from Blur, Hank Marvin of The Shadows, Jack White, Jeff Beck, Joe Walsh, John Squire of The Stone Roses, John Frusciante of Red Hot Chili Peppers, Johnny Marr of The Smith, Justin Hawkins of The Darkness, Kelly Jones of Stereophonics, Mark Knopfler, Mick Jones of The Clash, not Foreigner, Nile Rodgers from Chic, Noel Gallagher, Paul Stanley, Paul McCartney, Paul Weller. Paul McCartney's a bassist, not a guitar player, by the way. Paul Weller, Peter Green, Phil Manzanera, Phil Collin, and Viv Campbell from Def Leppard, not Phil Collins from Genesis, Phil Collin and Viv Campbell from Def Leppard, Robert Fripp from King Crimson, Sergio Pizzorni from Kazabian, Slash, Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols, Wayne Kramer of MC5, Wilco Johnson, and of course, Jimmy Page. And she's looking to raise money to get it. It's a 30-day or 60-day crowdsource. 29, 30 days. She's up to 800 pounds of her 16,000 total. So, but it's her first day. So if you're interested, and there's a video there, and I have the video on Ramble On Radio, and I have a link to the crowdsourcing, and see Scarlet Page talk, listen to her chat. And if you're interested in the book, by all means, send some cash. Problem from my side is the Canadian dollar is not what it once was, and it's that 50 pounds is actually $100. It starts to get, 50 is, that's a number you can live with. I will probably send money personally. I will probably do this one, but it won't be this week. Won't be this week with a $2,000 car bill sitting in the drawer. It will not be this week that I send $100 to Scarlet Page, but so those are what's new over at Ramble On Radio, the blog. Go on over and get your links and stuff. And we also have the Huts On For Nowhere reference mix, Into the Outdoor, Super Deluxe Edition, opening video, presents opening video, etc. There's lots of stuff over at RambleOnRadio.com. And there is not much Zeppelin news per se. However, I got you covered today. And I told you this is going to be a long one. I talked to Dave Lewis last Friday. I got two different interviews from Dave. The first one's over 40 minutes long, and that's the one we're going to play today. So we're talking about, he has a new book, another book. It's called, and I will put up a link in the next 2 days or so. I meant to do it before I did this, but... Five Glorious Nights. It's a visual look at the Earl's Court shows. Interesting thing about the Earl's Court show is as they are definitely Led Zeppelin at their musical peak, but they're also at their visual peak, and a huge number of the of what you recognize as Led Zeppelin visual is from Earl's Court. There's so many of the pictures have become iconic from those shows. So we talked about that. We talked about the shows, plus the book, plus we talked about the he had a chance to listen to do, go into one of the listenings of the remasters, and I wanted to start a I don't know if I want to do this. I want to start a Twitter campaign. And if you're on Twitter, tweet to Jimmy Page at Jimmy Page, tell him you want Ramble On Radio at Ramble On Radio. Or at Ramble On Blog, I believe is how I go for it. I only say it every time in my headline, right? At Ramble On Blog. So tell Jimmy, go to at Jimmy Page, say, want at Ramble On Blog at the Toronto. Is Ramble On Blog going to the Toronto listening? We want Tim at the listening, blah, blah, blah. Go to Twitter. If you're on Twitter, go to Twitter and do that. And let's see if we can... I'm trying to find somebody who can... I'm trying to find my way in. I'm trying to figure out who runs it. It's at the Masonic Temple. And it's been flipped hands a few times. It's actually owned by an IT firm now. I have no idea who's running, promoting the show. And I'm trying to figure that out. If I can figure that out, I'd probably get in. If anybody knows that, anybody in the Toronto area knows who is in charge of the press for that, let me know. But otherwise, yeah, over to Twitter, bug Jimmy Page a little. Let's see if we can get me in the door of a Jimmy Page event. And other than that, because we're not kids here anymore. It's not like we're 10. We'll just bug him until he says yes. But yeah, let's try that. Dave Lewis... So yeah, he got into a listening event, and he talks a little bit about what he heard at the listening event, and a few other things to boot. So here's Dave Lewis talking to me last Friday, July 3rd. And go. All right, so I'm here with Dave Lewis of Tight But Loose fame. Dave has been busy. Working on a new book about Earl's Court. Is the 39th edition of Tight But Loose magazine, and doing interviews with people like me. So, Dave, good.
Yeah, hi, how you doing?
Good, yourself?
Yeah, very well indeed.
Good to talk to you.
And you?
Do you know, by the way, you're on the, this is the 100th episode of Ramble On Radio.
So a privilege to be on the 100th. That's really great.
Celebrating a little milestone, anyway.
Absolutely.
So let's talk Earl's Court first. You had a quote in Facebook the other week that it was the height of the Led Zeppelin visual. I forget exactly how you put it, but that really a lot of the Led Zeppelin visual experience, as we know it, a huge amount of that comes from Earl's Court, doesn't it?
Well, it does, yeah. I mean, I think the whole thing with Earl's Court, it was such a peak. It was of their time, really. I think, you know, the whole thing in 6.5 years had been almost leading up to this. And I think after the American tour, which had started a bit slow with Jimmy being injured with his finger and Morris' voice, and then had really got momentum, particularly into the March period where they were doing the run of shows at LA, and they hadn't played in England for a long time properly since the 72-73 tour, which in those days, to be 2 years off the road, you know, was a long time. I mean, that isn't the way it is now. You know, bands can disappear for a while and then come back. People in England were expecting something special. And it had got to the point where I think Peter Grant in particular had thought that to do another tour around the country wasn't really where they were at that time. I mean, again, you've got to look at the logistics of what was happening with Led Zeppelin on stage, because things had got a whole lot bigger. Their stage presentation was now huge. There were laser beams, there was light show, there was a backdrop Led Zeppelin sign. The show was extended to 3 hours. Everything was big. So they needed to find the biggest place. The biggest indoor place was the Earl's Court Arena, which had a whole history in London of being an exhibition centre whereby yearly, you know, exhibitions were held, you know, for crafts and for home and stuff like that. But then it began to be used as a gig place, and this was really started by David Bowie in 1973, and he tested a concert there, and 17,000 people turned up, but it didn't go that well because the sound wasn't very good. It was a very big place, and lessons were learned, and the promoter of those gigs, Mel Bush, certainly learned some lessons. So the next band to go in there was Slade, actually, which is the pop and rock band who had lots of hits during the UK at that time. Nobby Holder, of course, came to the Midlands, as you know, as did Slade, so they had a good rapport with Lover. And I guess it got word got back to Peter Grant that the Earls Court Arena was the place to be. And because the sound had been tested and it seemed to be successful, Pink Floyd had gone in there as well. I think they went in there in 73 as well. So it was beginning to get a good reputation. So they announced the 3 dates in May, for May 23rd, 24th, 25th. They sold out instantly. And then they added 2 others for the May 17 and 18. So the whole momentum was really building in England. And I think because we haven't seen them for a while, and all these reports have been coming back from, you know, the US tours, the 73 and then the 75. And then there was the album, Physical Graffiti, which really had been, you know, a real blockbuster release, you know, to get a double album from Led Zeppelin. So the whole timing of the moment they went into Earls Court, I think, was crucial. And visually, England was ready for something special, and that's what they got.
You keep saying, Earls Court is a big place, you're saying. How big? What's the size of it?
17,000. So really, I guess, akin to like Madison Square Garden and LA Forum. But it was certainly the biggest indoor place. The only other thing we had at the time was the Wembley Empire Pool, which Led Zeppelin had played in 1971. That held 9,000. The Royal Albert Hall, which they played obviously before in 69 and 70, that only held 6,000. You know, I think to project what they wanted to project, it had to be something big. And the other thing to remember is that they were going to also test a video screen. Now, this is, you know, it's so commonplace now to have video screens on every festival and every gig. Back in England in 1975, that was pioneering, and it was strung up above the stage. I mean, looking back on it, it was quite archaic. There is one picture in the book of a face-on shot of the group underneath the stage, and it does look very quaint. But when we went there, and obviously in a crowd of 17,000, and for 2 or 3 of the shows, I was quite a way back, to see, you know, visuals of that height shot through a video camera totally in sync was something special. I mean, it was very exciting. And again, you've got to remember, this is a long time ago now. Concert presentation, you know, has moved on in leaps and bounds. But at the time, Led Zeppelin were very much a pioneer of something new and something different. And I think certainly Paul McCartney looked at that when they played there, and when Wings did their tour the following year, particularly when they went to America, they took the same type of laser beam. So plenty of bands were watching what they were doing, as always happened. I mean, you know, Rolling Stones went into Earls Court the next year. It suddenly became the place to play. But Zepp were right in there early. So I think, again, the reason I think a photo book works so well, which is, you know, the whole thing with, you know, Five Glorious Nights, which is a book I've just done, is that visually as well, they were at a peak again. You've got these startling images, and obviously the obvious one is Jimmy Page, you know, with the dragon suit, which was so, you know, iconic, and it was so mysterious, and it was so in keeping with Jimmy's image. You know, it looks very quaint now, but again, at the time, it was something special. You've got Robert and his preening Rock God best. You've got Jonesy in the quirky jackets with onions on. You've got John Bonham up there in a silver T-shirt, you know, now on a rostrum, which again had been something that had, you know, occurred during the 75 tour. That's where the drum rostrum first came in. You know, before that, he was just on the flat amongst the band. Suddenly, there was this big visual presence. And, you know, the photographers, which were sent mainly to cover for the what were then the weekly music papers, which is the Enemy and the Melody Maker and Disc and Record Mirror. Obviously, we're very much in the forefront of being able to project what this thing was like. So the coverage the next week in the Melody Maker and the Enemy in particular had some brilliant images. You know, it was a brilliantly shot show. It looked great. It looked great in black and white, and it looked great in colour. You know, there was something about the atmosphere of those pictures which conveyed the vastness of what Led Zeppelin was at that time. There's a thing that I need to mention, which is pretty important and pretty significant, and when you look back on it, quite bizarre, but I would say of the 85,000 people that went to Earls Court over those five shows, I would say 98% of the audience, possibly more, had never seen moving pictures of Led Zeppelin, because Led Zeppelin did not appear on television. There was very little live footage, you know, that was available. I would say the only thing would be the Super Show, which was rarely seen in England when they did those to Confused. So it's incredible to think people walked in, you know, having never seen them move. So I think, you know, that's an incredible thing when you think of YouTube now, and you can watch Earls Court now. You know, you can go on right now and put it on your phone. You know, in those days, just to see Led Zeppelin move in concert, which is what it was all about, was a, you know, a really special thing. So when the idea came up to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Led Zeppelin at Earls Court, I wanted to do something special. And I had got a plan to do a Tiger Loose publication in the scheme of Feather in the Wind and, you know, the Nebworth that I've done. But then a company called Rufus Stone came to me, and their publisher, Mark Smith, came to me and said he had an idea to do a large format photo book. Now, Mark had had good experience in doing books of this type. He'd done a very good one on Deep Purple at the California Jam. He'd done a Beatles one. He'd been involved in Mott the Hoople, Bill Wyman. And these books look great. Now, this changed the whole dynamic of what I was going to do, because suddenly there was a platform to be able to represent Earls Court visually in a photo book as never before. I mean, we've all seen lots of images of Earls Court. It's one of the most photographed set of gigs that Led Zeppelin ever did. And there's a lot of stuff that has been seen regularly, you know, and my objective and certainly my challenge from an early point in compiling this book was to find stuff that hadn't been seen. Now, Mark Smith came up with some very good sources, and he was in touch with the photographers of the day who had shot the show mainly, as I said, for the weekly newspapers, which is the Melody Maker and the Enemy. But people like Barry Plummer, Michael Putland, Dick Barnett, Ian Dixon, these guys were right there, and they had their contact sheets, and Mark Smith got very good access to those contact sheets. So step one of building this book was for him to show me what he'd got, and I was quite startled by something in the region of 350 images from those shows shot by those, you know, photographers. So from an early point, we had a lot to choose from, and I was aware that a lot of this hadn't been seen. The skill then was to how we were going to present it, and that's where it took a while to come together.
It sounds like a great book, and it's interesting that it's such, like, I would consider maybe 10% of the Led Zeppelin pictures that you see are probably from Earls Court. There's a huge number out there. And the fact that you guys are finding a big pile more is, that's really impressive.
I did see some comments on the message boards very early on when it was, you know, apparent that I was doing this book, and people saying it won't be worth it, you know, anything unless it's got unseen images. And I took that on board, because I knew, as a fan, I wanted to see more of Earls Court and more of a very different type of images, you know. And that's what the quest was, to try and find the stuff that was different. And to give you an example, again, with someone like Barry Plummer, he would have had three or four shots in Melody Maker. And I know there's a shot of Jimmy with a violin bow, and it's a famous shot, and people have seen quite a lot. What we've got is the next 10 shots along. So as he was, you know, clicking the shutter, you know, the next 10 went on a contact sheet, but were never used and were never really looked at. So obviously the aim was to keep the quality, and I must at this point make reference to Ross Halfin, who came in as a picture editor for me. He, you know, I'm in touch with Ross quite a lot, and obviously, you know, being one of the world's foremost rock photographers, it was great to get his view. And we went through a whole load of stuff. And the next objective was to bring it down to a manageable length. And we were looking for about 250 photos from about 375. So we had to discard a fair amount. Some just weren't usable. There's quite a lot of blurred stuff, out of focus. But by about March, I would say, we had a pool of photos. So that was step one. The next step, which again, I was very aware of, and was one of the reasons for doing the book, was that I did not want this to be a book that just flung a few pictures of Earl's Court into a book and said, there's Led Zeppelin at Earl's Court. From the title, it was, you know, evident five glorious nights needed to represent the five shows. So we tried to work out, which was very hard, which photos came from where and which nights. That was difficult in itself because a lot of the shots are from the May 17 and 18 shows because they were shot to be in the Melody Maker and the Enemy the next week. There is quite a lot from the 24th and 25th, not as much. There's not much from the 23rd. We had to take a bit of artistic license in laying them out, but the idea with the book, as you know, if you see it, you'll understand, is that it opens with May 17, the set list, story of the gig, and then you get a set of photos, mainly taken from that night, some not. You then move on to May 18 and 23rd and 24th and 25th. So throughout the 288 pages of the book, you have the story of the gigs unfolded. And the other thing that I did and was painstakingly in trying to do was to put it in set list order. So you begin with Rock and Roll. You know, it goes into Sick Again, into In My Time of Dying, into Song of Make the Same Rain Song, into Kashmir, into the acoustic set, out of the acoustic set, into Trampled, into Days, Moby Dick, into Stairway, into the Encores. As you can tell, I know these gigs well. you know, I definitely wanted to have that sequence represented as best we could over each night to give the readers the continuity and the atmosphere of those nights. Because again, as we all know as Led Zeppelin fans, it was a very special set list because it was the only time they played Tangerine in the four-part harmony. It was the only time they had a full acoustic set. You know, it was one of the longest shows they ever played. You know, when they went to America in 77, it was very much revamped. And again, the 75 US tour had not had an acoustic set. So Earl's Court, even for that reason, you know, alone, is a special set of gigs. The fact that musically, I think it's Led Zeppelin at a height. I think they're at the height of their powers. And I think when you look at the photos, you can see the confidence, the bravado, the arrogance of knowing they were number one. And whoever was number two was so far behind, they didn't need to turn up. Because Led Zeppelin, at that point, were all points planet rock. They just were. They were on top of the tree. Things got a lot harder, as we know, after 1970. Five when they came off stage. That was the last that I put it in the book, the last of the glory years. What was once pretty effortless for them became an effort because you got Robert's accident, you got the tragedy, you know, of Coward dying, you've got, you know, lots of things getting in the way for them being a working rock and roll band, which they'd found so part and parcel of what they did for the first 6 years of their existence. So I think Earl's Court again draws a line under the history of Led Zeppelin because it is the last of the peak years, and there was no finer peak in my opinion, and I was lucky enough to be there all five nights, than those nights, those five glorious nights at Earl's Court.
Yes, they sound like I listened recently to all the bootlegs, and there's they were so good, so on top of the game. You know, everything was perfect, right? They were well rested, but well rehearsed. They'd coming off their tour a month before. Everything was perfect, and they really were on fire.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. I mean, there were some great gigs at the end of 75 US tour that, you know, I always, you know, point out. The LA Forum nights are great. The No Quarter is getting longer. The Dazed is getting longer with things like Woodstock in it, and you know, they were just going on any tangent. And I think, as well, again, one of the things in the book, there's a lot of quotes in there from the British press at the time, and it was one of the first times they really got Led Zeppelin. I think, you know, they'd suffered with the press, more in America than England, but, you know, suddenly, you know, a lot of the national newspapers were, you know, you just didn't get coverage of rock music in things like the Daily Mail or the Independent, or not the Independent, it wasn't going then, the Financial Times, for instance. But people wanted to know what this group was about, this group that was selling millions of records in America and selling out in America had suddenly landed in England again, and people wanted to know what the fuss was about, and it was a big, big fuss. But again, because they didn't appear on television, because they weren't on Top of the Pops, because they didn't release singles, it was very much still a big cult. You know, I've said before, it was the world's biggest cult act, really, because a lot of the media didn't really understand. I mean, if you know, walk down the street in 1975 and ask someone to name a Led Zeppelin song, a lot of people would have struggled. You know, I mean, nowadays, you know, it's a lot different. There's, you know, there's been 40 years, you know, in between. But at the time, I think it was the point where Led Zeppelin became very accepted in the media here, and that continued on, into Nebworth and beyond. So, you know, what I like about the book and what I'm pleased with is that I think it captures the atmosphere of those shows, and it's like almost watching a moving video through pictures. But, you know, we've seen the video, I mean, not seen all of it, there's plenty of bootlegs out now, and obviously there's the six tracks that were on the official DVD, which look fantastic, and maybe one day we may see more, or we may not. But what's there is great. But this is, I do describe it as like a moving picture book, if you like, because you are watching the set progress, you are watching the nights progress, and you're watching their smiles and their, you know, their confidence, and you know, they just were on it. So it's always been a long-held, you know, ambition to do an Els Court book properly. And, I've got to say thanks to Mark Smith and his team at Rufus Stone, because this is a high-value book. We're not, you know, this is not something that's a cheap book. It looks fantastic. It's a limited edition of 1,000. It is £100 or just over. So we are asking people to spend a lot of money. I think this is an iconic book that, you know, is a bit of history. It's a bit of social history almost, because, again, in the life of a band, this is where it got bigger than ever. And we all know that 40 years on, Led Zeppelin is bigger than ever, and it's still in the present tense. Now, when I went to those shows 40 years ago, we never ever knew, you know, in 40 years' time, I never thought I'd be, you know, creating a photo book about all this. But as we can tell with the interest and, you know, the sort of, you know, fanaticism from things like your pod, my magazine, the countless websites, etc., that interest is still there. And for lots of younger fans who weren't even born when they played then, it's great to be able to have these things. So, yes, we're asking for people to shell out quite a lot of money. I think this is a lasting book that you can pick off the shelf at any time. It's not one of those things that you'll file away, because every time you want to play Els Court, and any time is good to play that, you can bring the book out, and it will give you the visual, you know, experience. I think it's the only photo book, I'm sure it is, of one set of gigs. There's been photo books of the 77 tour, Neil Preston, and a few other bits. But, you know, to hone in on five nights, I think he's quite pioneering. So I knew that was a challenge, to make it really interesting. But I'm very pleased with the amount of shots that we've got that are very different, haven't been seen, and I would say that's 60%. I've seen a lot of Els Court pictures in my time, but I would say that 60% of this is new to me, and the other 40% is great to have, because they're great shots, you know, and there's a good combination of colour, you know, and you're trying to represent everybody as well. Again, it's more difficult, you know, with John Bonham and John Paul Jones, because they were less photographed, but we've tried to project them as best we can into it. There's loads of great group shots. And the reaction so far has been pretty amazing. I mean, people have got it, have really got what we've tried to do. And I think it does look a beautiful thing. So So it's a great relief it's out there, and it's been a lot of work. It was done fairly quickly. We wanted it out, obviously, during the summer to celebrate the 40 years of Earl's Court. We tried to get it out for May, but we missed it slightly. But literally, I was working on it every day from January the 6th up until about May the 20th. So it was non-stop. But, and we worked with a great, great guy who does all the TV out there called Mick Lowe, who works here locally out of Bedford. And one of the things I said to Mark Smith, the publisher, is that I would want Mick to do the design because he knows the way we work with the mag, and he's done a fantastic job. So all round, I think it is Five Glorious Nights represented in a way that they've never been. So I'm really pleased with that.
And so it is Five Glorious Nights. It's called Rufus Stone Publishing.
Rufus Stone Publications, yeah. Five Glorious Nights, Led Zeppelin and Earl's Court, May 1975, 288 pages. The standard edition, which looks fantastic, is a large format book. It's album size, so it's like, you know, it does look like an album. It's a weighty bit of kit. Looks great. There was a special edition that sold out. There was 100 of those, which is a leather bound with a metal outer case, and they have all gone. I dare say some of those may turn up on eBay.
Yeah, I wouldn't be
surprised if they did. But the standard version, which is still fantastic, is readily available. I'm sure it will sell out at some point. But if people want to understand what Led Zeppelin was like at the height of his career, this is the book that will tell them.
And where will people get it then?
Okay, it's on the Rufus Stone website, which I will read out. www.rufuspublications.com. If they go to that, the link is on there to order the book, and readily available now. And as I said, some of the reaction we've had so far has been fantastic. So, it was a big challenge. I did feel a lot of pressure to get this right. It is a hallowed part of Led Zeppelin's history. Jimmy Page has seen the book, and he was most impressed. He was particularly impressed with the amount of photos that he'd never seen. So I take that as a huge compliment. As I say, Ross did a great job with us. It was a team effort, but the end result was to project these concerts, some of, if not the most important concerts Led Zeppelin ever played, in the right context, so people could really understand what this was all about. And every time you look at those pictures, the music comes alive, because they really were the top of the tree.
So the most important question, did Jimmy have to pay for his copy of the book?
I might charge him half, actually. I might let him off a tenner.
Okay.
I think I'm out to be charged with the book. He was really impressed, which is, that's fantastic, obviously. And it was a challenge. You know, I did feel, you know, I've taught these gigs up for 40 years, and I've done various, you know, articles and features and stuff. So, yeah, I definitely wanted to make sure it worked well, and I think there was a lot of pressure to make sure it looked good. And it did the subject matter justice, because these are hallowed gigs. But I'm pleased, and I think, yeah, anyone, as I said, that picks it up is going to enjoy it time and time again, because we know how much, you know, fun and enjoyment people get out of playing the CDs and, you know, watching the DVD. Earl's Court has got a resonance. I'm not saying they were the only great concerts, because they obviously weren't. There was lots of other series of concert greatness, the LA Forum 77, Japan 71, Fillmore 69, across the whole of their career. But there was something about Led Zeppelin on stage at Earl's Court which was uniquely special and still has that mystique and resonance about it. And when you look at the pictures, you're watching Led Zeppelin with the audience in the palm of their hands, and they know how good they are. And when you look at those pictures, that comes over. It's fantastic.
Excellent. And I'll make sure I get that website posted on the on my website too.
It's all cool.
Yeah.
It's all cool.
Yeah.
Thank you, Brian.
No problems. Moving on, we're at the latest edition, number 39 of Tight But Loose, is in the works and almost done. And you've interviewed Jimmy a second time?
Yes, I did. Yeah. It was during the week of the Olympic Series playback, which is on the Tuesday. And he was doing a series of interviews on the Thursday. And I was able to, again, get a slot during the media of the day. There was quite a few magazines that were in there as well, people like Mojo and such like. So I got about 35 minutes. It was a lot less rushed than before. When I did it, when he was promoting Led Zeppelin 4 and House of the Holy, it was behind schedule on that day when I did it in Kensington. So I was a bit more relaxed. It was great, really, because the pitch I took was literally just for him to talk through the companion disc audio across the three albums, which Presence, Into the Outdoor, and Coda. And it was a real, in the end, it was a bit of a Led Zeppelin love it, really, because it was me saying to Jimmy, that sounds great, and it was him saying to me, that sounds great. And in between that, he was explaining, obviously, why it sounds great. So it was great to do it, and he was very enthusiastic about many tracks. I mean, things like, the Achilles reference mix, which had got the Bombay tracks, which he's very pleased with out there. I mean, the whole of the Coda companion disc, which he had been keeping under wraps for a long time, because that was the one he had indicated to me, on occasions that there was going to be surprises. Now, I know you can't please all the people all the time. There's always going to be people saying, where's Swan Song, where's the long version of All My Love, etc. But Jimmy will only release what he sees fit, and we have to respect that. But within that, I think there's some fantastic stuff. So Tristan's Sword, which is the instrumental from 1970, is a cooking jam. And he said to me, it was like, that's got the feeling of the improvisations which they did nightly on stage. It's almost like they're in the studio and they're on stage. So I think people are going to love that. There's some of the outtakes are great. The One Ton Song mix is just awesome. There's loads of great stuff. And I think these last three, in a lot of ways, he has saved the best till last. And the other one that's going to get a lot of plaudits is the early version of When the Levee Breaks, If It Keeps on Raining, which was done at the end of 1970. And again, as he explains to me, a lot of bands would have thought, that's it, we've got it, it's in the can, that'll do. But when they got to Hedley Grange and the drum sound, they totally reworked it again. But it's great to hear this original version. It's real swampy and it's real... It's just, again, it really cooks. Plant's vocals are really laid back. So, lots of surprises. And again, it's been great to obviously hear those and then discuss them with Jimmy, who, again, has done a great job. Here we are at the end of this series, and who knows what's going to be next or what. I don't mean giving too much away yet. But it's job done. I don't think anyone has worked as hard on any set of reissues or anything as much as Jimmy has done on these. And again, he's pretty much around the world promoting these final three in the next month. I know he's going to Canada, and I think he's going to Japan. He's just been in Paris. He's obviously done London. That's great. That's in the mag. And obviously very timely that we're going out just as all this is about to, happen, because they've been released on July 31st. But Jimmy was great company. And I said, it was just like a bit of a Led Zeppelin loving. It was... no finer loving to be had than, with Jimmy Page.
Yeah, he's the guy to have it with.
Responsible for this this band and his band of musicians. And he was great playing up all the stories that he's able to tell. Because, if anyone is proud of what this band represented, then obviously it's him. And I think he's done such a great job. And it was a difficult job, I can understand. Like I said earlier, you can't please all the people all the time. But what is there, particularly across the three of them, I think people are going to really enjoy this stuff. It is great. So that's just in there amongst the 40,000 words. And we've got some other great stuff. We've got Larry Bergman Jr. has done a great piece on Jimmy's soundtrack set, which came out. And almost got a bit lost, really, amongst all the reissues, because I think that's a significant release. Obviously the extra stuff on Lisa Rising. Death Wish 2, so there's great stuff on there. Bringing it up to date, there's a report on the Robert Plant, Alison Krauss show for Lead Belly at 2125. Obviously some stuff on Els Court, as it would be, and great coverage of all the other reissues that have come out. So this one, has got a great, variety of stuff, and as I always say, if you love Led Zeppelin, you'll love this magazine, simple as that.
Simple as that.
And it's great to get the 39th issue out for the summer.
And you have Jimmy on the cover, right? Did I see that?
Yeah, there's a great shot of Jimmy on the cover. It's actually something we were going to use for the Els Corps book, but then he didn't quite make it. But I really wanted it. So it's a shot actually by a guy called Stuart Whitehead, who was a fan who shot from the audience. And he shot some of the best audience photos I think I've ever seen on Led Zeppelin. They're widely seen across the internet. But this one I hadn't seen before. And it's like it's a shot of Jimmy in the red ice, in the red dry ice as they're coming out of days. So it looks, yeah, it's got a lot of atmosphere. You know, you always want something striking. Obviously, you know, with the Hot Topic being 40 years of Earl's Court, it was great to be able to project something like that. I think it really stands up and just captures, again, the atmosphere of that period.
Good, yeah. I knew there was something in the back of my mind I wanted to go on, and you brought it up, the playbacks. You've heard the all three bonus discs, haven't you? The whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, on the playback, Jimmy presented 10 tracks.
Right.
And in true Jimmy style, he did them as a playlist. And there was a lot of thought process gone into why he did them in that order, which he told me about. And again, one of the things he said was it was on purpose that he had Friends from the Bombay Sessions first. Because for a lot of the media that were there, a lot of the journalists who probably wouldn't understand Led Zeppelin like I would, or you would, or he would, I think he wanted to illustrate that this is, this was a band that could do anything at any point, and if they wanted to go into a territory like, with the Bombay Orchestra and do something different, they could. And it's interesting that the Friends is has a drone going through it, and then the next drone you hear on the playback was the reference mix of In the Evening, the rough mix. And then we heard the One Ton song, Sugar Mama, which again, I think is a great track. I mean, that's a great lost track, from the early sessions. It's just so alive, and it's got a lot of Yardbirds spark in it.
Just a loose jam, right?
So we also heard Sugar Mama, Poor Tom. And the other one that is a bit of a standout is this thing they're calling Pod, which is an instrumental from the present sessions, which is just startlingly reflective. It opens with a long John Paul Jones piano piece, and it's very much in the vein of an In the Light, a 10 Years Gone. So where we all thought that the piano had been kept in the flight case when they got to Munich, not so. It wasn't just about guitar, drums and bass, which is how the album turned out. There were reflective moments. There were moments that, and I think Pod is a moment where they would have gone back and there would have been some lyrics and it would have been a bit of a romantic Zeppelin type of epic. But at the time, they had 3 weeks, as Jimmy explained to me, to get finished, and there wasn't really time to go back to it. So I think he's very pleased to be able to find something like that and represent that era in a very different way. So we heard that, Fall in the Rain, rough mix, Bonzo's Montreux, which again, in Olympic Studios, they've got this amazing playback, which is now a cinema. And in the cinema, which is actually engineered by a guy called Chris Kimsey, who used to work for Rolling Stones and worked at Olympic Studios, you hear it as you never will again. Even, I think Jimmy's made reference to that. So it was great hearing that. I mean, yeah, you realise what an achievement that was. It is a drum orchestra. Then we heard Two Ways of One, which is the Kimmy's Last Stand reference mix. It Keeps on Raining, which I said earlier is a reference mix of Levy Breaks. So the sequencing was great. I mean, I've been very lucky to attend all of those. And I think Jimmy's been very keen to project in the best setting for the sound those tracks. And that's why they chose, Olympic Studios. Plus the fact they're able to go back to where they actually recorded all those years ago. So I think it's been fantastic for him to be able to do that, and it's been a real thrill, I must admit. I feel very privileged to have been able to see that and hear it.
Sounds, yeah. I'm really hoping to get into the Toronto one. I'm emailing everybody I can find, but
they are something special. I know he's done some things in America, and I'm sure there'll be some more ahead for these three. So really exciting, good stuff.
Yeah, I'm hoping I can get. It would be great, but if not, yeah. Anyway, so I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay. Brian, always good to talk to you.
Yeah, so it's tblweb.com, right?
No. Try it again. It's
typeoutloose.co.uk.
Type the loose.co.uk. You can can get the magazine from there. You can subscribe for 3 issues, or you can buy the single issue. But during the summer of Led Zeppelin, which we're about to get big time, Under Loose is essential reading. And I very much would like everyone who's listening to this to buy a copy, because, like I said, if you love Led Zeppelin, you'll love Under Loose.
And I will post that link as well.
Super.
And we'll make sure we get some people sent over to you.
Okay, thanks, Brian.
All right, thanks, Dave. And that was Dave Lewis from Tight But Loose, remarkable Led Zeppelin author. His magazine, Tight But Loose, is so good. His books are so good. If you're a Led Zeppelin fan and you're not buying Dave Lewis's stuff, you're not subscribing to Tight But Loose, you're missing out. If you're not picked up his 2 books, well, he's got a number of books, but the 2 ones that I really love are is one on Nebworth, and the one where Feather in the Wind over Europe 1980. It's on the 1980 tour, which ended, as I pointed out. Now, I've done this podcast over the course of a couple of days, so it was 3 days ago. Now I probably said today or yesterday or something earlier in the podcast, but it was July 7th was the final concert in Berlin. The final concert of that, the 1982, and we're going to talk next week. Now, listen to me. If you came for the Dave Lewis, Dave, today we talked about his new book. It's a picture book from on the Earl's Court show. People are just getting it now. In the last day or two, I've seen some people on Facebook and stuff saying, "Oh, unbelievable book! This is so good." So that book's in store, getting there now. There's going to be a link at the website, rambleonradio.com. It will be up this afternoon, sometime today. It will be up. I will have a full link for Dave Lewis's website and for Five Glorious Nights. But if you came to hear Dave Lewis, if Dave Lewis promoted this on his Facebook page, and you came over to hear Dave Lewis speak, we heard Earl's Court, we heard him talk about Earl's Court, we heard him talk about Tight But Loose 39. We heard him talk about hearing the remasters and his second interview with Jimmy Page. Took him almost 40 years to get the first interview. He got the second one 6 months later. So come back again next week, because I have more Dave Lewis next week. Next week we're going to be talking the tour, the 1980 tour. I'm going to go over it in some detail. I'm going to look at night by night, show by show. I'm going to be talking about Dave Lewis's book. It's virtually the only research you have on this subject. It was such a small scale tour. There's just no real information out there about it that hasn't come from, you know, pieces scrapped together from the internet or what Dave Lewis has done. And Dave went to a number of the shows. He went to some of the early shows, and he had to go back and do some work, and then he had a few days off, and he ran out again. And he caught 3 of the last. He didn't catch the final Berlin show, but he was side stage in Mannheim. We're going to talk about that all next week. I got more Dave Lewis next week. So if you're here this week for the Dave Lewis, listen to me. Just subscribe. Go. I don't demand people do anything. It's not how I run this thing. But I'm telling you now, go to iTunes, click on the subscribe button. Go to Spreaker.com, follow me. That counts. That's important for 2 reasons. One is because I'm gonna submit this particular episode to iHeartRadio. So hopefully, you know, if lots of people have subscribed in the next couple of days. But beyond that, it's on podcast or Podbeam as well. Podbean. I am Brian Dammit/Podbean. I believe is how that one works. But go to rambleonradio.com. I'll have a link to it all up there. But here's, just subscribe, because next week, Dave Lewis, the week after that, assuming scheduling works the way I think it's going to, I've already agreed to an interview with somebody else. You are not going to want to miss this interview. This is going to be a great one. I'm really, really looking forward to this one. I'm telling you, you want to hear the next 2 shows as two. If you just popped over to hear the one because it's Dave Lewis, I'm telling you, you're going to want to hear the next 2. Promise. So, that's going to be it for episode 100. Thank you. If you've been listening since episode 1, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's I can't believe I'm at 100. It's almost bizarre to me. I wondered, as I did the first one, as I think you heard at the beginning, I wondered if I would do a second. And here I'm at 100, and exciting things are happening, and there's been so much Led Zeppelin to talk about over the 4 years. It's phenomenal. It really is. And looking at the list, it was August 2011, so it has been almost exactly 4 years, really. You know, we're 3 years, 11 months, in essence. So thank you. Thank you for listening. If you pick this up at episode 40, 50, 80, if you're just listening to the last couple, whichever it is, thank you. I appreciate it. And so that is going to be it. I'm going to leave you with two things, something I never do, a whole song. But first is going to be on episode 4 on the, it was in September, would have been the 31st anniversary of the passing of John Bonham. I did a tribute, I put together a little tribute, about a minute and a half. It was the intro, had some sound clips and that sort of stuff. I'm going to play that for you. And then I'm going to play, from the 1982, the final show, the opening song, Train Kept a Rollin'. And I'm going to, I never do this, but I'm going to play the whole song. So thank you. That was Ramble On Radio, episode 100. Thank you for listening. I'm trying to remember how it all goes, how the words go. I hate this. So much for the Off the Cuff Podcasting Network, right? Check RambleOnRadio.com for notes on next week's podcast. I've already written a fairly comprehensive thing, so go on over and click the links. Led Zeppelin, check RambleOnRadio.com for next week's podcast, plus Led Zeppelin news and reviews and any links mentioned in today's podcast. Follow Ramble On Radio on Facebook, Google+, and at RambleOnBlog on Twitter. You can subscribe to Ramble On Radio through iTunes. You can listen on Spreaker, Spreaker. Follow me on Spreaker. If you go to iTunes, if you're in iTunes, leave a review. If you're on Spreaker, follow Ramble On Radio on Spreaker. And check it out at Ramble On Radio on YouTube. Thanks for listening to Ramble On Radio, episode 100. It's been such a pleasure to be doing this for the last 4 years. And I thank you for listening. And here's a tribute to John Bonham, followed by Train Kept Rollin' from July 7, 1980.
John Bonham, the drummer for Led Zeppelin, is dead at the age of 32.
To me, hands down, John Bonham's the best rock drummer.
The European tour did have one show canceled because Bonham was physically exhausted.
The style and the sound was so identifiable to one person.
We do not know the cause of death. There will be a post-mortem in due course.
He was actually better than anybody else.
Bonham was found lying in bed by John Paul Jones after a night's sleep at Jimmy Page's home.
Could you imagine the cop telling his superintendent, like, you know, who do you have? He goes, well, I have the drummer with Led Zeppelin. I have the drummer with the Beatles. Inspector Clouseau, Peter Sellers, and Oliver Reed.
I'm Switch off the internet.